Okay, welcome everyone. Today is March 16th, 2017, and I'm opening the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2011. Cassie, could you please read? And Ryan, if you'd like to come up and join the speaker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2011 directs Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to administer a study assessing disparities between federal and local fair market rent calculations. The bill establishes the Task Force on Housing Authority Capacity to assess housing authority capacity to provide services, determine methods to enhance capacity for housing authorities, and examine feasibility of implementing a state-sponsored housing voucher program. The Task Force sunsets on December 31st, 2018, and the bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Good morning, colleagues. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Good to see you this morning. This morning, we're talking about House Bill 2011. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill before you. As you remember, I spoke about Section 8, the Housing Choice Voucher Program, earlier in the session. Just to remind folks, this is about 30,000 Oregon households, a federal program administered by 22 local housing authorities, almost $200 million. A year in federal funds that flow to our state to help individuals have help with their rent in the private market, and it involves about 13,000 private landlords every year. I'm going to deviate just slightly from my testimony. In Portland, in the last day or so, Home Forward, which is the Portland Housing Authority, they opened up their waiting list for the Section 8 voucher program back in December. 16,000 people applied for that voucher program. 3,000 moved to the wait list for that program. Just the other day, Home Forward did something they have never done. They sent a letter to those individuals on the wait list and said, we're not going to be able to do any vouchers in 2017. Any new vouchers. Because of what they're hearing from the federal government in terms of budget cuts. That's a substantial impact on a very important program in our state. So I just wanted to give you that news. I think that's pretty sobering about the challenges we have with that program. But this program does work. What we do in the state around Section 8 is very valuable, and we should never underestimate that. Except we have a little problem. Rents are rising, and how the price of a voucher is calculated is a problem. So that's what this bill is about. Under the Housing Choice Voucher Program, a tenant pays 30% of their income towards the cost of housing. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development then subsidizes the difference between the tenant share and the fair market rent of the geographic area, which HUD calculates by averaging rents in a geographic area. Unfortunately, the data that HUD uses to estimate the fair market rent is outdated, and their calculations are chronically below the actual fair market rent of the geographic area. After waiting for years to get a voucher, a family can be forced to return it because they are unable to find a home that they can afford with the subsidy. And this has been happening more recently, given the current market. Undervaluing fair market rent is a problem not only for the tenants who are unable to find the units that they can afford with the subsidy, but this undervaluation also puts our federal resources at risk because HUD will not budget future funds to our housing authorities if they don't spend the money. So if vouchers go unused, HUD will not fund those vouchers in the next budget cycle. So add insult to injury with that one. To respond to this problem, Home Forward in Multnomah County, our housing authority there, commissioned an independent research organization to assess the region's fair market rent. In 2015, the study they commissioned found that the HUD's fair market calculations were far below the actual fair market rent of the Portland metropolitan area. Home Forward used the study's findings as evidence to successfully petition HUD for a 28% increase in their fair market rent. As a result of this increase and additional coordination efforts, Home Forward was able to increase their voucher lease-up rate from 67.8% before the new fair market rent kicked in to 79.6% in January of this year. So given that if we know the fair market rent and we can petition, we need to do something about it. So this is what House Bill 2011 would do. First, the bill directs the Housing Community Services Department to commission an independent research study on fair market rent in a region if the housing authority of that region chooses to opt into such a study. In its current form, and there will be an amendment to the bill directs the department to then petition HUD for increased fair market rent following the completion of the study. We're going to do an amendment that will clarify that if there's more than one housing authority in a region, they have to all want to opt into the study, because that does happen in some parts of the state. And secondly, we would clarify that it would be the housing authority and not the State Department who would submit a petition to HUD for changing the fair market rent. And you'll hear some of that from Ryan. So second, the bill, and this is about sustainability of figuring this problem out, would commission a task force to examine the capacity within our current 22 housing authorities broadly and explore the feasibility of implementing a state-funded voucher program. We've had this conversation on and off for years. We know there's a gap between the federal voucher program in terms of need and what we're able to do. We have to have a serious conversation of, and I'm not sure what it would cost, whether we could actually fill the gap with a state-funded voucher program. So this bill calls for a task force to do that. We will have an amendment that clarifies to add that gap analysis into the study they would be doing. So given everything we have to do around housing and our affordable housing crisis, we need to maximize the use of this program. We have to understand fair market rent. We have to get the feds to maybe give us a different rent number so these vouchers actually have more buying power. And we have to figure out how we go forward potentially with state-funded voucher program to supplement the federal. So lots in this bill. Really appreciate your time, and we'll take any questions. Thank you.
Chair Kinnegaier, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Authorities, which administer the Section 8 program, the Housing Choice Voucher program that you just heard very well introduced by the speaker. Just to give a little bit more detail, and you know, in researching this bill, I've been on the phone directly with folks from HUD to better understand the process behind the calculation of fair market rents. And I'll get just a little bit into the technical aspect of the vouchers and how they work, just to kind of clarify why this is an important topic. So there are two numbers to know about. There is the fair market rent, which is the determination by HUD of, as the speaker said, what is the going rate for a place to rent. And this is important to HUD from a regulatory perspective, because they want the vouchers to go as far as possible, and they don't want vouchers, from their perspective, being used for places that are too expensive, would be their the way that I think the Congress would think about it. So they set this fair market rent standard. Then the housing authority has some flexibility based on that fair market rent to set what they call the payment standard. And so they could set the payment standard at 110% of the fair market rent, or 80 to 90% of the fair market rent. Now, again, there's a cap as to how much flexibility they have there. The issue is that by the time the fair market rent calculation is done, and it's based on census survey, and Representative Meek, Noble, and Nierman, you heard a lot of discussion about this yesterday in the Transportation Economic Development Ways and Means Committee. You saw that chart, and the you noted correctly that the data ends at 2015. Well, the issue is that by the time the fair market rent calculation comes out, there's yet another year that has passed. So whereas the census data is 2 years old, the fair market rent is based on data that is 3 years old. And what they do is they look at a national level of increase over the last several years, and they apply that to estimate forward what the fair market rent should be 3 years later. In this housing market, those estimates have been very short of what the actual rent increases have been, as the study that the speaker referenced showed. So the issue is that it was not easy for the metro region to do this study. And so what this bill would do is it would allow other areas to be able to do this, because part of why Home Forward was able to do it is because they are a larger housing authority. They have a special status with HUD that allows more administrative flexibility, and so they were able to allocate resources to do this. A couple things to note about resetting the fair market rents, and this is why the opt-in part of this bill is important. There is a double-edged sword here, because if you increase the payment standard, then that means that the amount per voucher that you are going to be paying out is going to increase. And as for the way that the voucher program works, you don't have a limited number of vouchers. You have a limited amount of funds that can be administered through those vouchers. So the more that the cost of each voucher goes up, the less vouchers that you'll be able to put out on the street. And so each housing authority will need to make a determination whether or not they feel that their issue is with the fair market rent, or if that is not as much of an issue as getting as many vouchers out as possible. And so that's why that opt-in portion is important. And the reason that it would be, if there is more than one housing authority impacted, the metro region, their fair market rent area, their fair market rent region actually includes seven counties, one of them being in Washington. And so when that study was accepted and that waiver was accepted, all seven counties had their fair market rent reset. In one of those counties, they weren't having the same problem, but their fair market rents were raised. And so that's why it's important that there needs to be a discussion among all of the impacted housing authorities. What happened in terms of, we had a good ending with the metropolitan region because HUD recognized that this second side of the double-edged sword existed, and they actually provided more funds to most of the counties within that region to cover the difference. I would just mention a couple other things. One is that fair market rent does not just impact housing authorities. It impacts all federal housing funding. And so, as you know, I also work with the community action agencies. They administer federal rent assistance funds. They have that same fair market rent issue. They do not have the flexibility like the housing authorities do to go to 110%. So if it's $5 over fair market rent, they cannot use federal funds, which I would be remiss if I didn't say that's why the emergency housing account here in Oregon is so important, because that allows them to help those families that are $5 over that fair market rent standard. Just a couple other pieces of the amendments that are important. It's important that the housing authorities submit the waiver and not Housing and Community Services. HUD won't accept it from a third party. The waiver request needs to come from the housing authority. And then with regards to the task force, you know, the capacity of housing authorities has been really taxed by the way that HUD has funded the program. Even at HUD's own calculations, the housing authorities are receiving a fraction of what it is they need to actually administer the program. So they have to subsidize it in other ways. And one thing that the state has done in the past that's been very helpful is they have provided some one-time grants to housing authorities that have allowed them to do certain things that have been able to make them operate more efficiently. Two examples of that. One is some one-time funds so that offices could convert to paperless work. And so multiple people can look at files at one time, less time filing. It's been very efficient. Another has been one-time funds to allow inspectors to use a tablet instead of a paper system when they're doing inspections. And especially in rural areas where you have one inspector, they may be covering three large Eastern Oregon counties. There were stories of an inspector driving two counties over inspecting a unit. The unit next to him needs to be inspected, and he gets a text that it needs to be inspected, but he has to drive back the two counties to get the paperwork, then drive the two counties again to inspect the unit that was next door to the one. With the tablet, he's able to just go next door and make that inspection. So I think there are other opportunities and capacity as well. So we're in support of this bill, assuming that the amendments come out the way that we've discussed. We really appreciate the Speaker's office working with us to develop this language, and happy to answer any questions.
Good. Any questions? Yes, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ryan, it seems to me that in order for this to work properly, if we're sending out vouchers that our families aren't able to use, you're in a conundrum that either you have to help more people or help people that can effectively get housing. And I'm not sure, will this be one of those answers?
Well, thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Meek. That's exactly why that opt-in piece is so important, because each housing authority is going to need to make the determination what is best, because if you're not able to utilize the vouchers, and the success rates across the state have been going down significantly because of the tight markets and the increased rents. So if you're not able to use your vouchers, then that is your biggest problem. And you need to be able to use those vouchers, as the speaker said, or you will lose those funds for the following funding cycle. However, if you can use your vouchers, then you may not want to make this adjustment because you want to be able to serve as many folks as possible.
Okay, very good. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? So I have what might seem like an obvious question. You probably have an obvious answer. Why have a task force to study it if you know that the local fair market value is higher, that other recent studies have shown that? Why not just let them go ahead and do that, and then they can decide whether they want to petition to use that other? And the other question is on page 2, line 12, you talk about petitioning the HUD to increase the value without decreasing the quantity. I'm assuming that means that you are making a case based on the local fair market value. Same number of vouchers, greater amount per voucher, a greater allocation. Maybe you're concerned that that's not going to happen, but you are asking for permission to go ahead and do that in the bill.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, there is a difference in terms of, to your first question, in terms of what the task force will study versus what the first part of the bill does. So the task force would be looking at other ways that the state could support the capacity of housing authorities, and then also making an analysis of what is the need versus the resource that we have in the state. And, you know, what the story that the speaker just told about Home Forward opening their list is an example of that. Mm-hmm. Housing authorities around the state have either large waiting lists or closed waiting lists. So that would be examining a separate question than whether or not we should do these studies. Okay. The bill would allow the studies to move forward. The task force would be looking at some other related issues and the ways that the state could address it. And I'm sorry, please remind me of the second question.
The question was, you had said in the bill that they could petition to ask for not only a higher amount, the local fair market shows that, but also not decreasing the quantity of vouchers. So it would be a request for a larger allocation.
Yes. So thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. As I said, with the metropolitan area example, HUD was able to provide additional resources.
Yep.
That was a gamble because those resources were not guaranteed until after the metro region had to make the decision to go forward and raise these fair market rents. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we could look at that language because, as I mentioned, the number of vouchers is not finite. It's the amount of money that can be allocated to through the voucher program. And so perhaps it would be best to ensure that the amount of funds that is available would not decrease. And, you know, we would probably also at least request that funds would be increased if the fair market rent was increased as well.
Okay.
But again, as I understand the way the waiver process works, that's not a guarantee.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2011, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2944, related issue. And while the speaker is still here, Cassie, could you read the summary? This is the Section 8 Mitigation Fund.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2944 requires a hearing for a landlord to prove the amount of damages eligible for the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program prior to judgment against the tenant. We last heard this bill on February 23rd. Today there is a Dash 4 amendment. The Dash 4 amendment repeals the requirement for the tenant to repay the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program for assistance paid to the landlord and becomes operative September 1st, 2017, and declares an emergency effective upon passage. We do have the fiscal and the revenue for the Dash 4 amendments, and both of them are minimal impacts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House, thank you for consideration of House Bill 2944, the Dash 4 amendments. We've had a lot of good feedback from members since our first public hearing on the bill. So the Dash 4 amendments does three things. To remind you, this is about a landlord guarantee fund that was set up to mitigate damage, but we've noticed some abuse in the program, so we're making some changes. The Dash 4 would add an emergency clause to the bill, so it goes into effect right away. However, it also adds an operative date of September 1 of this year for the landlords, because some landlords might have made claims on the fund. So we want to have a little lag time there so those claims can get through the system. So while the bill would go into effect immediately upon passage, you'd have a delay for the landlords who have claims into the fund already until September of this year. And lastly, in further discussion with members and looking at how the program's been set up, the amendment would also take out the requirement of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to send the tenants to collections. So if you recall, when there are damages, a landlord can apply to this fund. We're going to change with the underlying bill to say they have to, you know, go to the court with what the level of damages are, because we're seeing a lot of default judgments that aren't really based in fact, and we see some abuse of the system. So currently, the fund is set up that says the department should also ask the tenants to pay a little on the damages that have been found. There's a couple problems with that. One, as we had in the previous testimony, we have a lot of default judgments. We don't know if damages have actually happened. So that's one. So that's an underlying concern. The reason this, when this was set up to say that the department could send folks to collections, was seemed like a good idea at the time. But upon further reflection, now let's remember, there are accountability measures when a tenant with a voucher damages an apartment. Mm-hmm. They're basically breaking the lease if they damage the apartment, probably will lose their voucher. Nothing keeps the landlord from also sending folks to regular collections. What we're saying here is we should take out the portion that would have the department do the collections, because what we're finding is, and this is a strict fiscal accountability issue for the department, they are spending a lot of money and they're not getting a lot out of it. Right now, the department has spent over $44,000 to collect $7,000 from tenants to repay the fund. So again, it seemed like a good idea when we set it up. It's not practically doing anything. I mean, there are other ways to hold the tenants accountable for damages. So, and given the history of questionable default judgments and the inefficient use of funds this way, we're suggesting that should be repealed. Again, accountability is in other ways, but it doesn't make sense for the department to be doing this. So with that, happy to entertain questions or urge your support of the Dash 4 amendments in the passage of the bill if you're able to do that today. Thank you, colleagues.
Okay, questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Speaker.
Mm-hmm. Representative, good morning.
It's difficult for me to be looking down at you.
I love it. You look great up there on the deck.
Well, I'm I get where you're at with what's going on with the Dash 4s, but I kind of understand. I'm trying to follow the track that you're wanting to go for this too, as well, especially the last piece that you're talking about for the tenants and that collection. I mean, that does seem to be a problem. I mean, when the investment on trying to retrieve back isn't going to be, a lot less than what the outcome is. I have a problem, though, because I do feel, and I think you do too, as we all do up here, there's got to be a connection for accountability. If you have a tenant that does do damage, that somehow that gets restored by them somehow. So I guess my question is there a possibility somehow to involve the court through this process to make that good for the tenant to be involved with the restoration of that? Any thought on that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I suppose anything's possible. The fund was set up when we were having conversations with landlords. Remember when we were saying that you couldn't discriminate on the basis of your income and use of a voucher. And we set up this fund to say, we're going to help keep you whole if you have a problem with a tenant. I think at the time, this idea that we'd also ask tenants to help refund the fund, it's just not very practical. It's not really an accountability issue. There's an inability to pay. And so if we're keeping landlord, I mean, is it up to the state to be the one chasing those down, chasing folks down, when you can already do that through collections? in most cases, that tenant is going to have accountability. They're going to lose their voucher if they've substantially damaged the apartment. So I really don't think that it makes sense to have the agency. Right now, we're spending almost $6 for every dollar that we collect. So if we really thought we were going to refund this guarantee fund to going after tenants, I don't think anyone assumed that was actually going to happen. And now we look at these numbers and it doesn't make any sense. Whether or not we can involve the courts, I mean, nothing keeps the landlord from trying to collect. The challenge with the Section 8 folks is we're talking with folks with not a lot of income to begin with. And that's why we set up the guarantee fund. So the state is the guarantor. If there's a problem, we're trying to make that work for landlords. But whether or not the tenants have the money, I think we're showing they don't. It's not a good use of state dollars to try to track that down, and there are other accountability measures. And, you know, how the court gets involved, that's really up to the landlord as well. They could pursue that as well in small claims court if they wanted to.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. Madam Speaker, on the idea of that there's nothing that prevents the landlord from trying to collect, I'm trying to understand how that would work. So if I'm a landlord and someone has trashed my house, and I go to the assistance or the guarantee program, and the state pays for that damage, I can still go try to get that tenant to pay for the damaged door?
And Madam Chair, Representative Stark, to my understanding, yes.
And I can follow up. My name is, for the record, my name is Taylor Smiley-Wolf, and I work with the Speaker, Chair Kinnegan, and Representative Stark. So the fund will pay anywhere between $500 to $5,000 in damage. So if damage was done to your apartment in excess of $5,000, the fund can pay up to $5,000, and then you can pursue the remainder through a private collections agency.
And to follow up, Madam Chair and Representative, again, whether or not we can collect from the tenant will not change that number.
Representative Stark.
Do we have a motion yet? We're
not at the point of a motion yet, or the explanation.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. So I don't like the idea. It's my feeling that if you tell someone they're not going to be accountable for something, then they're more likely to have bad behavior. So if somebody knows that they're not going to have to pay for a door that's been kicked in, then they're more likely to kick in that door. And so whether we're spending more money on it or not, I fear that if we remove that accountability, then that we will have more damage and it will cost us more. That being said, I love this bill. I actually really like the bill in the original form. I like the emergency clause on it. I like the effective date you're putting on it. I am going to go ahead and support the bill. I like it less now because I'm not all that comfortable, but knowing that, you know, according to Taylor, that landlords can still pursue a judgment against them, that there is still accountability, I'll go ahead and support it because of that knowledge.
And Madam Chair and Representative Stark, thank you for your comments, and I really respect your perspective on this. I would say that I don't fundamentally believe that a Section 8 holder who damages the apartment is cognizant of the Landlord Guarantee Fund, number one. If someone, and again, I would argue there's no greater impact on what happens in these apartments, whether you're a Section 8 holder or someone else. But when we made this agreement with the landlords to say we're going to have a way to back you up in case there is a problem, which was kind of the deal we made when we talked about non-discrimination. The reality is there's already the bigger accountability is really whether or not you're going to lose your voucher. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is on. If someone is worried about holding a voucher holder accountable, it's really about that. The lease will be broken, very likely to lose their voucher.
And have a record.
And not be able to rent. I mean, so I think it's mm-hmm. how you look at it. I just don't really think that someone's sitting there going, I'm going to do more damage because I'm not going to be held accountable through this fund from the state. I just don't think that's happening. So while I get your piece, I think the accountability already exists. And we were, I think, at some time saying, is this a way to get more money back into the fund? And the reality is it's not.
Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I want to speak in support of this. And just to clarify that we're talking about a default judgment. And with that judgment, it's not against the state, it's against that tenant. So they are receiving damages, and they are going to be held accountable for them. They're going to have that judgment on their record. And in order for them to ever rent again, they're going to have to satisfy that. What I'd like to see in the future, if we can work on helping them satisfy that, is maybe they don't have funds, maybe they can do some community service, maybe cleaning up some apartments, painting some of these affordable housing units. But I think right now we're being fiscally responsible with our money, and I think this bill is the right way to do that, because the state chasing these funds is, and at $6 per one on recovery, is not the way to do it. But I do believe they're going to be held accountable, and that's, I like the way you've this bill has been redrafted, and I look forward to supporting it. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Speaker Cote.
I am going to stand at ease for 1 minute at the. Okay, calling us back to order, and we're continuing the work session on House Bill 2944. Representative Kotek.
Madam Chair, colleagues, thank you. One final comment. I was reminded for folks who worked on the underlying bill back in 2013. There will be consequences for the voucher holder if there's damage. They're, again, likely to lose the voucher. There's nothing holding the housing authorities back from doing, you know, some of the things that Representative Meek suggested necessarily around community service. However, when we set up the non-discrimination piece of source of income, while a landlord couldn't discriminate based on having a voucher, there's nothing that keeps a landlord from looking at the history of the renter. Mm-hmm. So this default would be on the record if there was a default judgment on damages. And those things could all be considered if that person somehow maintained their voucher and was trying to rent up again. So I feel like accountability will follow the person in a way that is probably more impactful than whether or not they are making up a difference in some of the damage. So just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other further questions? All right, then, Vice Chair, could you please make a motion?
Yes. Chair Kinney-Geyer, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 3/13/17.
Okay, Representative Sanchez moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments on House Bill 2944, dated 3/13/17. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, I move House Bill 2944 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sanchez moves House Bill 2944 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Yeoman.
Thanks, Chair Kinney-Geyer. I just wanted to say for the record that I'm a Section 8 landlord, and I haven't ever had a chance to access this fund, but I may do that in the future. So I just want to be transparent about that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? All right. If not, could you please call the roll?
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Yes.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Palooza?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kinney-Geyer?
Aye. The motion passes. Representative Kotek, would you like to carry this on the floor?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you. Great. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2944, and I'm going to open the work session on, I'm sorry, the public hearing on House Bill 2959 with Representative Stark. We may have to cut this off at 8. Well, we do have to cut it off in a few minutes, and then we'll return to it because Representative Nathanson can only be here. No, you can come up. We can do about 5 minutes.
Good morning, Chair Kinney-Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. Before we continue, would love to point out that you guys have an unusual audience today. In the back, you have about a dozen students and parents from New Hope Christian School in right in one of the corners of my district. They can all wave to you.
Oh, wait.
They make a trip up
sit
here.
Down.
Oh, they want you to stay standing for a second.
Taking a picture.
They make a trip up here every year in order to learn about the campus. They get the Don Phillips special tour, which if you guys have not taken that, you should. It's educational, given that she's been around since about the time the building opened.
Oh.
Oh. Well, she at least has the historical knowledge.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what I hope the state police
are fired.
Moving on to the bill. House Bill 2959. Quite frankly, I'm frustrated that we're having this conversation yet again. For those who are new, a little bit of history on this. And the General Assistance Program has been around for a long time. Years ago, we approved this as, you know, a legislative body. And in short, these guys can tell you more in detail the specifics of it. But in short, when there's someone who's homeless and they're on the waiting list to receive their Social Security benefits, you know, supplemental benefits and disability benefits, when they're on that wait list, which sometimes can be up to 2 years with the feds, well, this helps them during that gap period. Okay, and what ends up happening is we go ahead and help them with housing and cash assistance and in other ways and so forth for those people that we are certain, now not 100% certain, but close to, that they are going to receive those federal benefits. So we basically front the benefits, and then when the feds begin their benefits, the feds typically backdate it to when they began, and we get reimbursed that. So we end up getting reimbursed 80-85% of the money that we put into this. This is a great program to help people who are homeless. We've already had that discussion. We had that discussion years ago, and then the funding kind of disappeared. And then we had it in 2015. We were talking about bringing it back as a pilot program, and this specific committee, which was made up of different members at the time, said, we love this, but why are you doing a pilot? Don't waste money on a program. We know we love it. Take it out. So John Mullen went and did some good work in 2016, and this body passed this bill unanimous through the entire building, saying this is good stuff. Let's make sure we're taking care of these homeless individuals in this way. This is a great investment of our money. So here we are a year later. The program is up and running. It's taken a little bit longer to get going than we thought, but we knew that the investment was going to be primarily on the upfront part, and from that point on that, you know, we'd start seeing the returns from the feds and so forth. So we're at that point. And the reason for this bill is because when we got a good look at the governor's budget, it cut the funding for this program. And we have this bill to say, and I'm hoping this body will say once again collectively, no, we're not going to cut the funding from this. We need to keep this going. We've already had this conversation. This is a priority, and we want to make sure that the funding is there for it. So I'm here to support this. Hopefully we can find ways to put the funding back in, and we want to make sure we're having this conversation. On that note, I'll turn the details over to these guys.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I want to thank Representative Stark for opening up the discussion, and there's really very little more that I want to say other than to talk about the fact that the Oregon Law Center has been a strong supporter of general assistance going way back. And I really want to thank all of you. We have champions on this bill. Representative Stark has just been so terrific. He was co-vice chair along with Representative Peluso in the 2016 session when the bill passed under your leadership, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, now that he's back on the committee, has been a strong champion. Representative Sanchez, who's new as a co-sponsor of this particular bill. So in expressing thanks, I also want to thank the opportunity to work with the Department of Human Services and the advisory committee role that was provided for by House Bill 4042, the bill that you passed in the 16th session. We had a very strong collaborative working relationship, really broad-based and inclusive participation. And then finally, I would just say that we really want to thank our partners out there, not only the people that supported this all the way along, but then when it came to implementation, the community action agencies, the Aging Disability Resource Connections were really very important in having the initial successes we're having in this program. So again, as Representative Stark said, this bill would otherwise not be necessary. What the bill just simply does is a fill in the blank about how much it will cost for the next biennium. And so when you get to a work session on this, which we hope will happen fairly soon, we will be able to have that number and then pass it down to Ways and Means for their deliberation. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and I know we have to take a little bit of a pause perhaps after Erica, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erica Miller. I am a program manager with the Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, Collaborative Disability Determination Unit. I'm here today to provide an update on our current general assistance program. As you may know, the GA program is funded to provide monthly housing assistance, utility assistance, and a small cash payment to up to 200 adults without minor children living with them who have severe disabilities that meet Social Security disability criteria and who are homeless or at imminent risk of homelessness. GA individuals must agree to pursue Supplemental Security Income, SSI, benefits, and the department provides free assistance with this process via our highly trained disability analysts. Once an individual is awarded SSI, the department is able to recover at least a portion of the GA funds paid to the individual. The department had the pleasure of working with John Mullen, Janet Merrill, and many other advocates and stakeholders on the GA Advisory Group as we prepared to launch the program, which improved our connections with numerous community partners, including local community action agencies, and led to the development of a community partner-specific referral form, program metrics, and a process for maintaining our attorney list. With Janet Merrill's assistance, DHS was able to make contact with and train all of the local community action agencies on the GA program and the use of the community partner referral form prior to the implementation of the program on July 1st, 2016. And DHS continues to provide GA training to internal partners as well as external partners on a monthly basis. Since July 1st of 2016, we received 905 GA referrals from DHS, APD, and AAA offices and 65 community partner organizations. 390 individuals are currently engaged in the GA application process, and over 400 individuals have been determined to be ineligible for the program. It's important to note that a portion of the individuals who've been denied GA benefits were denied because we determined that they had already been awarded Social Security benefits, but they were not aware of that fact until we provided assistance. Other common reasons for GA denials are not meeting the program's homeless criteria and having minor children in the home. As of Monday, March 13th, 75 individuals have been approved for GA benefits. 67% of our current GA consumers have been housed. Over 70% of our housed consumers are renting a room in someone's home. Of the 33% of the population who remain unhoused, the majority of consumers are couch surfing with friends and family or living on the streets. 19 GA individuals have been awarded SSI benefits thus far, and these individuals receive over $11,000 per month in ongoing Social Security benefits. To date, the department has recouped over $19,000 in GA benefits paid, and the department has spent less than 10% of the $1.39 million allocated for GA consumers' monetary assistance this biennium. Department staff are working very hard to serve this challenging population. Contacting homeless consumers by mail and phone can be difficult, if not impossible, at times. And staff make home visits under bridges and in the woods, delivering paperwork by hand, and doing what they can to meet our consumers' needs. Staff are also transporting consumers to needed medical examinations and Social Security appointments to ensure they are able to obtain the Social Security benefits to which they are entitled. Once consumers are housed, staff are helping consumers obtain donated items with which to furnish their homes, including for one consumer a refrigerator. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the General Assistance Program. You will find detailed information about our caseload and consumers, housing status, and more information in the documents we've provided on OLIS. This includes a brief fact sheet on GA, which will contain much of the data that's been shared here today, as well as maps which show the statewide distribution of our GA population. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Okay, great. And I just want to add to that that Representative Olson was actually a chief sponsor of this before he even came onto this committee. So it shows a long-time commitment. There are four chief sponsors. All four of them happen now to be on the committee. They weren't when we actually dropped the bill, and two are Republican, two are Democrat. And I think is that right?
Oh, that's terrible.
I think that it's Did you want to? Oh, she's here. Okay, great. So we're going to suspend this now and hear from the other people signed up. I'm suspending the hearing on House Bill 2959, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3262 with Representative Nathanson. Representative Nathanson, I'm sorry. We were trying to get a hold of you because I didn't see you behind there.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. Psychotropic drugs are a tool to help improve mood and behavior. They can improve quality of life, provide relief in end-of-life care, and aid children and adolescents with detrimental impulse behaviors. But they can be used improperly to address behavioral issues caused by dementia and developmental disabilities, including aggression, agitation, hyperactivity, and delirium. This is especially true when elderly people and persons with disabilities are living in long-term care facilities. And these drugs have serious side effects when used for a diagnosis for which their use is not intended. This is called off-label use, and the FDA has given what's called a black box warning to antipsychotic drugs and antidepressants and their off-label use, calling attention to serious or life-threatening risks associated with unapproved uses. Evidence from clinical trials shows little benefit from using such medications for persons with dementia or disabilities. In fact, it shows that they often don't work to treat challenging behavior. The data also shows that these drugs have significant side effects, such as excessive sedation, physical complications, cognitive decline, increased risks of falls, and even death. For every 28 elderly people treated for a year with an antidepressant, one will die who would have lived otherwise from causes including heart attacks, strokes, and falls. That's because these medications can make people drowsy, dizzy, confused, and restless. They can also cause diabetes and heart failure. You have in your file of testimony submitted on this bill comments from Kevin Modesti, a surgeon practicing in general surgery and surgical critical care in Eugene. He had hoped to be here today, but he couldn't be here today. He emphasizes data reporting moderate to severe injuries and falls of older adults and association with the use of sedatives and hypnotics, antidepressants, and benzodiazepines. He describes the side effects of psychotropic medications, and on the second page of his testimony, he provides a clinical scenario. I hope that you've also read the testimony of someone else who had hoped to be here in Salem today but couldn't, from Bob Nickel, a mental health and addictions professional with more than 30 years' experience who works closely with the Boston medical journalist Robert Whitaker, who has a specialized knowledge of unbiased research literature on the effects and side effects of psychiatric medications. Mr. Nickel explains the national attention that is being given this issue, the magnitude of the problem, the risks and expense of these medications, and how this bill would benefit Oregonians. These issues and poor outcomes are caused by inappropriate use of the drug, and they are exacerbated by overprescribing, drug interactions, and lack of proper medical management. Data indicates that antipsychotics are often used for individuals with dementia for sustained long-term periods with limited monitoring of their effects. It also shows that individuals with disabilities receive excessively high dosage that exceed FDA recommendations. You may hear that we don't have a problem in Oregon. A statewide average for the use of psychotropics shows a pretty good number. But as you know, and you know I'm a numbers person, but you all have to look at numbers a lot too, an average can obscure a few very bad situations when it's added in with good results elsewhere. It's those bad situations that deserve our attention and those people who deserve our protection. And beyond the cost to the individual's well-being or even life, the cost of psychotropic drugs in Oregon is significant, estimated to be up to $200 million annually for the public system alone. Non-drug strategies can be used. They include personal assessments to address behavioral issues and develop alternative solutions. For example, strategies might include music, art, and light therapies or psychosocial supports. Many behaviors can be attenuated by identifying the cause of the behavior and then addressing an unmet physical or social need, such as simple physical needs, hunger, thirst, pain, or discomfort, or even those social aspects such as tiredness, boredom, and loneliness. Person-centered appropriate non-drug treatments can help caregivers focus on a person's needs and abilities and can help individuals develop helping behaviors to promote that sense of self-control and direction. So what can we do for Oregon? This bill aims to reduce the known risks and improve the safety of seniors and people with disabilities living in adult foster homes, residential care facilities, and long-term care facilities. The bill directs DHS to collaborate with medical boards and DHS facility regulatory entities to adopt rules regulating the prescription of psychotropic medications. If the prescription is written by a healthcare practitioner other than the primary care physician, the prescription must be reviewed by the primary care provider. That second set of eyes will help limit the risks of the side effects of the prescription, the dosage, or the drug combination problems. And please note that we have submitted an amendment to you making it clear that instead of referring only to a primary care physician, in the amendment it refers to that second set of eyes can be the primary care provider, gerontologist, psychiatrist, or other professional as designated by the health authority rule. The bill requires a person-centered assessment before continued administration of a psychotropic drug. That requirement, though, please note, it's not for everybody. It's not for all seniors and all persons with disabilities. It applies only to those in nursing homes, assisted living or residential care, and adult foster care. And the bill still allows for up to two doses for use in case of an urgent medical need. We recognize that something may come up and there is an urgent need and there's not time for a more thorough assessment before a critical emergency dose is needed. So by increasing oversight of these drugs, especially when they are prescribed for an unintended or off-label use, we reduce the risk of serious side effects, including the risk of costly injury. We also create an opportunity for long-term care providers to identify potential non-pharmaceutical alternative interventions that could be used. You may hear that in another bill, psychotropics or antipsychotics are included with a number of other care facility-related topics, such as reporting the use for data collection. I would note that that data would be provided by the facility with no way of easily validating the accuracy of the data. But beyond that, there is already plenty of data. There are national studies which the professionals and the surgeon have provided you with outside links to. There is plenty of data that demonstrate that there's a problem. We need to do something more than just collect data and suggest best practices. We need to protect our more vulnerable Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the representative? We've got three more people to testify on it. Yes. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Representative Nathanson,
four people.
I've been surprised so far in the last couple of years in this building by the power and speed at which the Department of Human Services can at times adopt rules and do away with rules and implement emergency rules and so forth. When looking at this, this seems like something they could just do. What is preventing the department from doing this without a bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Stark, I'd rather you ask the department about that. I suppose that it's probably for the same reasons that at the national level, there are some best practices that have been adopted and some headway is being made. But this is a large and important problem. And I think it takes a lot of care to make sure that you get it right. And just speaking in plain, simple terms, the department would probably appreciate legislative direction rather than just doing it on their own.
Kickstart.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Garrett. Just a comment anecdotally, since my wife works in home health, I hear stories of this all the time. I think this is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Any other? Thank you, Representative Nathanson. All right, so I'm going to call up Jim Davis, Fred Steele, Linda Kirschbaum.
That's exactly what she's talking about.
And we'll have one more person after that.
To keep them quiet.
So if you can be as brief in your testimony as possible, we've got a lot of other bills to go through.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, a psychologist and gerontologist, today representing United Seniors and the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, state affiliates of the National Council on Aging. I'm here to provide support of HB 3262. For decades, I have been a champion of senior and people with disability behavioral health problems. I had the honor of co-chairing with Senator Mona Sanderson in the legislative work group on senior and disability mental health and addictions, where we came up with some significant recommendations, many of which that have been adopted by the legislature and led to the older adults and people with disabilities behavioral health initiative. We have specialists that are now throughout the state, 24 specialists that are out the state. It's a cooperative partnership with the Oregon Health Authority and DHS. And I have the honor of chairing that advisory council for the state on that one. One of the very critical concerns that we are able to address in these efforts is the misuse, and abuse of prescription drugs by elders and people with disabilities, but particularly by elders. Seniors consume about one-third of all prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs in the United States. So it's really easy to just even applying basic data to this population to see the potentially significant addiction problems that can exist around this, and particularly around psychotropic drugs that are emphasized in this legislation, but also pain meds. Seniors take a lot of drugs, and it's been an ignored problem in terms of how they react to those drugs. Less than 1% of addiction services deal with seniors or people with disabilities. A couple of other points. In this bill, it addresses psychotropics in nursing homes, adult foster homes, and residential care facilities, where there are some definite problems with prescription drug use and misuse. Oftentimes, it's too easy or convenient a solution to utilize psychotropic drugs. I like in this legislation the review or screening that is done outside the primary care physician and now other mental health professionals as well for looking at non-pharmaceutical options. I would like to see a stronger emphasis in this legislation around what some of those options could be, such as counseling, support groups, drug safety education. I'd like to see those issues addressed, because when you address those issues, oftentimes some of the other problems go away. You analyze the drugs, you begin to treat if there are addictions, things such as that. In addition, I'd like to see in this legislation the Oregon Health Authority added as a partner along with DHS. The Oregon Health Authority has principal responsibility for our behavioral health initiative, the community mental health centers, addiction services. Most of our specialists, senior and disability behavioral health specialists, are housed in Oregon Health Authority. So I very much would appreciate that being added as well. Finally, we appreciate initiatives that respond to the misuse and abuse of psychotropic drugs. This is a neglected and serious problem, and I support the effort of the representative to bring attention to this.
Thank you very much.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I'm the state long-term care ombudsman. Really just wanted to take a minute this morning to convey support for the concept that is being provided in this legislation. As the chief advocate for residents of these care facilities, from our office's understanding and knowledge, and I've been in this role for about 18 months, We know it's a problem. We know there are concerns with the use of psychotropics, but we actually don't know the degree to which that is a problem here in Oregon. There's quite a bit of national attention on the issue, and I think there are some things being done in Oregon. But with this legislation, it's a good kickstarter to encourage and compel Department of Human Services to look at this from a regulatory perspective, but in particular with the experts, the Board of Pharmacy, the Medical Board, Nursing Board, to be able to craft some rules to do some better regulatory approaches and just kind of monitor the use of these medications for individuals. Because when these medications are being used, it becomes a violation or misused, it becomes a violation of that individual's rights and a violation of their independence. And for the ombudsman, that's where we're coming from. So thank you
very much.
Okay. Chair Kenny-Guyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I plan to share some efforts that have been underway to improve antipsychotic and psychotropic meds. For the record, my name is Linda Kirschbaum. I'm the Senior Vice President of Quality Services with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We'd like to also thank Representative Nathanson for her interest in this important health and quality of life topic. In my role at OHCA, most of my work focuses on quality improvement, patient safety practice, education, and quality initiatives. The work shared today is a result of a longstanding dedication to collaborative work amongst the quality long-term care partners in this state. Work is accomplished through using quality assurance and performance improvement models when problems are identified or areas for improvement are identified. In 2012, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid launched a national campaign to improve quality of life for persons with dementia. The Oregon Quality Partners eagerly came together, as we do often, to be active state participant in this broad national effort to reduce off-label use of antipsychotics for persons with dementia. The campaign was driven by emerging evidence that highlighted the potential serious side effects associated with these medicines for diagnoses where they were not intended to be used. While the initial goal was to reduce the use of antipsychotics, the partnership's larger mission was really to promote person-centered, non-pharmacological interventions to address those issues. We went to work, the Oregon Partnership to Improve Dementia Care Work Group was brought together that same year in 2012, consists of the Department of Human Services, our organization, the Alzheimer's Association, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, Dr. Bill Simonson from the Oregon State University Pharmacy School, Dr. Maureen Nash, who is the medical director at Providence Place, and also the former medical director at Quality Center for Geriatric Psychiatry, Ombudsman,
Linda,
and quite a few other experts.
I'm hoping you can submit your testimony so we can get all this background.
Absolutely.
And if you can really just speak to the bill, whether you're in favor or whether you want any.
We're in support of just continuing efforts and really looking at this issue from a global standpoint. There are a lot of regulations. There are brand new nursing home regulations that just came out, as well as a number of pilots that are examining this in community-based care. We're not only measuring the use and the reduction of these types of medications, but also incorporating strategies for people to do these active medication reviews. So a number of efforts underway currently addressing this. We would just want to make sure that any public policy supports current efforts and doesn't duplicate or put additional burden on those efforts.
Okay, thank you so much. And last one is Courtney Dresser. Oh, I guess there's two now. Courtney Dresser and Dr. Anne McQueen, if you can be very brief just to state for the record and submit your testimony so we can get a more full picture of how you feel.
Good morning. Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. We're very appreciative of the bill, the Dash 1 amendments. Our only concern still is requirement for review, and do wonder if we should hold off on that requirement for notification or for review and more of a requirement of notification until all the parties and experts can come together through the DHS process and rulemaking process to determine if that is an appropriate thing to do. We are appreciative that the definition of primary care physician has been expanded to other providers, but our concern was if there was no primary care provider, what would happen? Would care be delayed? And so it might be more appropriate to kind of take that requirement piece and turn that into a notification piece until the groups can come together, experts can come together and determine if that is truly an appropriate way to do it. We usually don't necessarily advocate for that type of policy to be put into legislation, into statute. So we would ask that the committee consider that change in the Dash 1.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Anne McQueen, for the record. I have a PhD in gerontology with specialty work related to Alzheimer's and dementia. I am currently the administrator of the Safety Oversight and Quality Unit for Aging and People with Disabilities within DHS. Our unit is the regulatory body for long-term care facilities throughout the state. I wanted to offer some context to this bill. Antipsychotics are one family of drugs under a larger umbrella of a class called psychotropics, and there are two classes of antipsychotics. Atypical antipsychotics are the second generation or new generation of these. There are also first generation antipsychotics, just so you're aware, as you may see in literature, about the differences between those. In numerous studies, drugs in both of those groups of antipsychotics have been shown to have dangerous side effects, strokes, fractures, kidney injury, and mortality. Older adults with dementia in particular face an increased risk of death from these medications. As Representative Nathanson stated, it's such a serious problem that the FDA has placed its most serious warning, called a black box, on the off-label or unapproved use of these medications. Despite these risks, recent research funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, showed that the percentage of people receiving an antipsychotic prescription increased with age after age 65. In their recent study, the percentage of older people with an antipsychotic prescription was approximately twice as high among people 80 to 84 years old as among those aged 65 to 69. And researchers stated unequivocally, quote, "The results of the study suggest a need to focus on new ways to treat the underlying causes of agitation and confusion in the elderly. The public health community needs to give greater attention to targeted environmental and behavioral treatments rather than medications."
And if you could wrap up, because we need to get to other bills.
Medication should never be the first or only line of defense in addressing dementia-related behaviors, and there are a variety of evidence-based non-pharmacological approaches that have been shown to reduce or eliminate the need for antipsychotics. I don't have time to share them today, but I'm happy to do that.
And if you could submit that for the record, that would be
great. Yes, absolutely.
I assume as an agency person you're not able to advocate in favor of a particular bill, but that you're pointing out the great need.
That's correct.
To address the
That's
issue.
Correct. Our agency does remain neutral on this bill, but we've been happy to present some information to Representative Nathanson. Thank you.
Great. And I'm very sorry to cut you off. I
no,
want to make
that's
sure we
fine.
Get to the other.
Thank you for your
okay.
time this morning.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3262 and reopen the public hearing on 2959. And ask you all to be as brief as you can. So we've got Phil Kenny Wong, Melanie Kelvin, and George Wall.
Madam Chair, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong with Oregon Food Bank. I've had the privilege for, I guess, several years now to help convene the General Assistance Coalition. And in fact, I hate to admit that I've been working on trying to restore General Assistance for over 12 years. Which means that I'm a really bad lobbyist, because not only did I get it passed, the governor took it out. So I just want to thank you for having faith in me again. And I want to first give a shout out to Rep. Olson for being an early believer, Rep. Stark and Rep. Sanchez for your continued leadership, and Rep. Kenny Geyer essentially for agreeing to introduce this legislation for two sessions in a row. I do have special guests. They are on a time limit. They are part of the General Assistance Coalition. I want to point out that there is a fact sheet that's on OLIS that lists all the current and past supporters. And I've asked these two folks who are on the front lines working with folks who are eligible for general assistance to come up to share their experience with you. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm George Wall. I'm an attorney in Portland, and my client base are people applying for Social Security Disability and SSI. And I have a success story for you. One of my clients was one of the first to be granted general assistance last September. He'd been homeless for many years and is suicidal. With the cash grant, he's been able to buy toilet articles, toilet paper, soap, just the basics. With the housing assistance, he's been able to get off the streets and get a room finally. After 6 years, he's finally been granted Social Security benefits, and general assistance will be repaid as soon as Social Security gets around to processing the payment. In the year before he got general assistance, he was admitted to psychiatric units 4 times for a total of 26 days of inpatient treatment. He spent 6 months in an extended care facility, all this paid for by the Oregon Health Plan. Since receiving general assistance, he has had no emergency room visits or hospitalizations. His GA benefits have probably amounted to about $3,500 to date. And I don't know what it costs to keep somebody in a psychiatric unit, but it's at least $1,200 to $1,500 a day. So the state has made its money back manyfold simply on savings and medical costs for this gentleman. GA benefits the poorest of the poor, people who have really no voice, who are homeless, can't work, usually mentally ill and physically ill, and with histories of substance abuse. And this is one program my clients and I work with a lot of agencies and social services programs, and this one works. I hope you continue to fund it. This program gets the money back for the state, works for the clients, and as far as I can tell, the people who work in it get the job done without a lot of fuss. So I hope you'll continue this.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Melanie Calvin. I'm the executive director of a tiny little nonprofit in Portland called ASSIST, Assertive SSI Service Team. And we are federal application specialists also. Our goal, our mission is to keep these cases out of the horrible national appeals backlog, and we have a high success rate. And I want to let you know that I've worked with the CDU team, Erica Miller's team, for years, and they employ the same mission.
Can you say what CDU is?
I'm sorry, Collaborative Disability Determination Unit. Did I quite get that right? They are a crackerjack team. Erica mentioned highly trained, and that means that they are specialists in the Social Security disability criteria, which is very strict. And so their success rates are tremendous in keeping these cases out of the horrible appeals backlog and getting people off the streets. It's a direct service. It's a direct action to help. The state of Oregon can help end homelessness for our most vulnerable. I, too, was one of the first ones to submit an application to their unit. One of my clients, I want to just briefly tell you about her. We have her permission. She was from Oregon City, Clackamas County. She's 48 years old, and she'd been homeless for over a year. And I want to just give you the list of her diagnoses as well. She suffered from chronic and very painful pancreatitis, renal failure, significant depression and anxiety, and chronic fatigue from her illnesses, all of which were complicated by a psychologically based eating disorder. That is a very hard disorder to treat. We were so happy and so honored to be able to refer her to the General Assistance Program, and we, with record time, were successful in her efforts. So this is an incredibly valuable program, and I am here to support it as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. So next up, we have David Beam and Jim Davis. Again, if you could be very, very brief. I think David's no longer here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis. In this case, representing the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, the Oregon Disability Commission, as well as the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens and United Seniors of Oregon, state affiliates of the National Council on Aging. Very quickly, I just wanted to share with you the strong historic support within the senior and disability communities for the General Assistance Program. We were very excited when the funding came back in 2015, and of course John Mullen's efforts around this issue have been incredible, and he's one of our heroes. This is a critical source of financial support for the most needy, for the very low-income people with disabilities, oftentimes facing homelessness and medical crisis and other problems. And so we strongly urge your support of this measure.
Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2959, open a brief informational hearing on the Ombudsman. I understand this is the Ombudsman Day in the Capitol, so delighted to have you there. We're going to hear a very brief overview of the program since we're looking at a lot of the long-term care issues.
As the Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Fred Steele again, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and appreciate a few minutes on a very packed agenda, especially as long as some of these hearings have gone this morning. And I appreciate the Chair giving us these few minutes because today is, for us, a volunteer Ombudsman Day at the Capitol. We have our certified ombudsmen who provide their advocacy for residents of nursing facilities, assisted living, adult foster homes on a day-to-day basis, a week-to-week basis. That individualized advocacy that they provide around rights issues, working on medication issues, food issues, on up to eviction issues for residents of care facilities. For a little over 20 of them, we have over 190 volunteers throughout the state. We had about 20 that wanted to come in and at least for a day provide some systems advocacy. So I have with me today one of those volunteers, Sam Weiss. Wanted to at least have a few minutes so you could hear from him in this forum, in part for preparation for some bills that you're going to be hearing in the next week or two around long-term care, proposing enhancements, significant enhancements for the quality of life, quality of care of residents that are living in these facilities that are dependent upon the care, the care provided in those facilities, but this is their home. And Sam's going to be able to provide that perspective of one of these all-star volunteers that we have in the program. But also on what that life looks like for residents and the need for that legislation that's going to be coming before you in the next week or two. I'll turn it over to Sam. He has been with the program for over 13 years. That was before I got started, before I went to law school, before I got started with my own career work. And he has been a volunteer for over 13 years with his time for individuals just advocating for Oregonians. So let me turn it over to him with the time constraints here.
Good morning, Chair. Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Samuel Weiss, Captain, United States Army Reserve, retired, and a volunteer long-term care ombudsman. I mentioned my military service because I had several years of an assignment with the Army's Inspector General Corps, and that developed some skills which I use as an ombudsman. Because as a volunteer certified long-term ombudsman, my responsibility is to receive, investigate, and resolve complaints, issues, problems, and concerns from residents in long-term care facilities. So it's a very similar process. I would say that now that I'm 80 years old, however, I have trimmed back a little bit. I now have two assisted living facilities and two nursing facilities, both of which, by the way, are located in Senator Majority Leader Burdick and House Majority Leader Williamson's districts. I previously, though, was assigned to 26 adult care homes, as Multnomah County refers to the adult foster homes. But I have had to cut back a little. My two assisted living facilities have 270 beds, and I mentioned beds because that's the capacity. And the assisted living facilities have 250 apartments, which can vary about whether it's one or two people per. But I currently am assigned to these facilities with approximately 365 residents who are constantly available to contact me 24/7. The only time I've told them I've not been available is I did have a chance to go to Europe, mm-hmm. and my cell phone didn't work there. I tell my residents, by the way, my phone is always on, but there is one call I do not like to receive. That's the one they did not make. Mm-hmm. And so they know to contact me. My role assigned to these facilities is to enhance the quality of life, improve the level of care, provide residents' rights, and promote their dignity while living in an assisted facility. Foremost, this requires my knowledge, understanding, and applying the appropriate Oregon administrative rules pertaining to these facilities. And to give you an idea of what that involves, there are 361 pages in the administrative rules pertaining to assisted living and nursing facilities, and Multnomah County adds 116 pages for their foster or adult care homes for us to understand what is expected on their treatment. But you know, I'm not a licensor. I'm not an inspector. My job is to advocate for those residents, and therefore it depends on my abilities and our abilities as ombudsman to advocate, promote, and encourage the administration of those facilities to meet the appropriate actions to resolve the issues that have been brought to our attention. Well, that is a significant part of my position as an advocate for residents. There are some things that I do which are outside the range of the administrative rules. I'd like to give you a few examples of what, as an ombudsman, we do besides just follow the rules. On my own.
If you could maybe just limit it to two and then submit it for the testimony, that would be great. If you could limit your examples to two and then put it in the testimony, that would be great.
Well, the important is when Medicare Part D was initiated, I on my own attended the training to be able to assist residents in reviewing. And the reason that is important is because if you look at a Medicare Part D and try to figure out which one is best for you, you have to consider which plans are available in your area, what the premiums are that they charge, what deductions are included, what medications are included in the plan's formulary, and which pharmacies are involved in the plan's network. An example of that, I was just last week asked to assist a resident who continued their 2016 plan into 2017, only to find out that the pharmacy providing his medications are expected that this year to be in excess of $15,000. But by reviewing what is available, I found an alternative that reduced that down to just $4,400.
Wow.
So there can be some very significant there.
That's really good.
Using my own personal laptop supplies, I've assisted residents over 6 years, and in looking at their current plans and the plans available next year, we have been able to provide an estimate savings of in excess of $128,000.
Wow.
By their picking next year's plan, which better suits their needs than the current. So one of the other things that we involve in is actually one that takes even more time than we anticipated, and that is assisting in family relations. Mm-hmm. One case in particular that I'll limit to then is a resident whose two sons were at complete odds with each other, always arguing and causing the mother to have great despair to the point where she actually mentioned to me that her greatest achievement in life would be to see her sons reconciled before she died. I met with the sons, I met with the mother, I found out what the issues were, I got them to reconcile, and when she died, they were buddies, and she was so pleased that she could die knowing of this. I would throw in the other one of where I brought a couple to be able to live in the same facility together, but that will take more time. But I did want to give you some idea of what we do as ombudsman. We follow the rules. We receive, investigate, resolve concerns and issues. And we do what we do when residents ask us to. We are their advocate. They are our boss. We don't have to agree with them. We don't even think that they want to do which is best for them. But our job is to assist them to achieve what they can.
Thank you so much for your service.
Thank you for
your testimony. Thank you. Yeah, thank you
and
so much.
By the way, it was nice to see you again since you visited with us last fall.
Thank you so much. Nice to see you, too. Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Ombudsman program. Would love to spend more time on that. It's one of my absolute heartfelt passions. Incredible use of public dollars when you think about a little bit of money that goes to a coordinator, 190 volunteers that do the kind of work they do, and the dedication is unbelievable, I think. So, committee, I want to let you know that we are going to hold over the public hearing on House Bill 2433. We've already gotten that message to Julie Parrish. We are also going to hold over the work session on House Bill 2347, and we are going to now, so we're down to two things left, and we're going to have a public hearing now on House Bill 2919 with Representative Escobar, and then we have one final bill to work. Yes, Cassie, could you read the summary for the bill, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2919 requires senior community residents providing residential accommodations to persons 55 years of age or older to notify the Oregon Health Authority about provision of food services. The bill directs OHA to adopt rules establishing foodborne illness prevention program for senior community residents and requires OHA or the local public health authority to inspect senior community residences annually for compliance with foodborne illness prevention program. The bill requires the inspecting authority to impose corrective action on food services activities and allows OHA to impose a civil penalty or and suspension of food services activities for violations of the prevention program. The bill requires the persons involved in food services as senior community residents to complete a food handler training program. We do have a dash one amendment, and the dash one amendment changes the bill and amends the definition of restaurant establishment to include facility providing food services at senior community residence. The bill defines senior community residence as residential accommodations to persons 55 years of age or older and does not include facilities providing health care, mental health, dependency or disability needs, and or transient lodging or week-to-week tenancy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Sal Escobar, Representative District 6. Thanks for hearing this today, Madam Chair. Reason being, you just got me out of a GMO discussion. And we all know what that's like. So, anyway, the bill before you, 2919, and the amendment is the one I'd like to adapt to it. And the reason I'd like to adopt it, because it basically gut and stuffs the whole bill. And what this is, it came to my attention that in these 55 and older communities, we are not inspecting their kitchen facilities. And an individual that was working there came to me and said, you know, I'm going to put my mom in a home, and I don't think I want to do that because of what they were observing working in the facilities. And then they said, we've done some research and found out that they are not under anyone's jurisdiction. So just kind of a hole in the system. So before you have an amendment that basically guts and stuffs this bill, and what it does on ORS 624.10, it redefines this and puts it under the restaurant part of the statute for 55 and older. and you have to have, I think, five people or more in order to qualify. And what that does is it means that we don't have to rewrite the rules. We don't have to go to any expense. We just put them underneath there. And then the OHA will be under their overseeing what they're doing in their kitchen facilities. So it's pretty simplistic, actually. We're just adding them on. I'm available for questions except about GMO.
Any I don't questions, want to talk about I think GMO. We're going to have one person from...
Just really quick. Yes. Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So, Representative Esquivel, on your amendments here, dash ones, you have here provides residential accommodations for six or more households. How'd you come up with that number?
That was done by OHA. I don't know why they did that. They just decided that you know, that was adequate, I guess, because I think if you get into the other ones, you're getting into a little different type of a facility.
We are going to have someone from OHA.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing this to our. I'm sorry, Representative Stark.
Now, Stark, I knew he wouldn't let
thank
me.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer.
He doesn't want you to go back.
Representative
to that
Esquivel, I was just curious: are these facilities that serve GMO food? I'm joking. I will remove my question.
Representative Stark, I don't want to go there.
Okay. Thank you very much for
thank
bringing
you.
This
thanks
to our attention.
Thanks for hearing it, Madam
Chair. All right, great. So we have Gabriella Goldfarb from Oregon Health Authority.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gabriella Goldfarb. I head up the Environmental Public Health section at the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to speak to Representative Esquivel's bill, 2919. Actually, my testimony was submitted to you prior to the dash one coming through, so I'm going to depart a little bit from the substance is generally the same, but we'll depart from the testimony to speak to the more to the dash one. So HB 2919, as Rep. Esquivel mentioned, addresses a current gap in Oregon's food safety program by requiring senior community residence kitchens to meet best practices for food safety in food service establishments. And I just want to make clear, this is the these are facilities that do not offer care. They are the over at least one family member has to be at least 55. It's adults only, those types of communities. The bill, as introduced, would require OHA to adopt rules to establish a separate new inspection and enforcement program for these senior community residences. And we were in conversation with Rep. Esquivel, and the dash one did come out that offers us a way to accomplish the goals of the original bill at reduced cost while taking advantage of an existing food safety regulation program. So, as the dash one does, by modifying the existing statute to include senior community residence kitchens in the definition of kitchens subject to the state's existing food safety and regulatory program, you get rid of the need to do a whole new rulemaking. They'd have the same licensing, inspection, and enforcement provisions as any other food service establishment that serves the public. These kitchens do serve meals to older adults who may be more vulnerable to foodborne illnesses than other people, and for whom the result can be severe illness or death. In fact, according to surveillance data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the highest percentage of persons who were hospitalized with foodborne illness and who have eventually died from infection were those aged 65 and older. And actually, I have some additional data that's not in the testimony that for us in Oregon, between 1998 and 2015, we had over 570 foodborne outbreaks in the state. Certainly that isn't from these kinds of facilities necessarily, but it's just to illustrate that it is a concern in this. And that's not 571 people, that's 571 outbreaks that affected more than, more than necessarily one person. Oregon Health Authority currently has food service standards in place for similar facilities that are county partners in our county health departments license and inspect, such as senior meal sites and hospital kitchens. These standards are based upon national recommendations provided by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and they also include enforcement mechanisms similar to those that were required under 2919, the original bill. Making the change in the Dash 1 would result in no fiscal impact for OHA, would allow oversight of food service operations in these senior community facilities to be implemented as soon as the bill goes into effect, and there would be no additional rulemaking nor training. A lot of what we do is work with our county partners to deliver training in the latest practices. We wouldn't need a separate training program either. So I'd be happy to provide any additional information you need and appreciate the opportunity to speak to this bill.
Any questions for Representative Meek?
Thank you, Chair Kennegar. Related to once this passes, is there a database, or how do you find all the facilities that are providing this type of services now, and how do you notify them and get them online?
So I have actually in the room with me the lead for our food safety program, Dave Martin. If the Madam Chair, if you would permit him to join me.
Hi. Madam Chair and the committee, my name is Dave Martin. I'm the program coordinator for the Foodborne Illness Prevention Program, and we oversee the restaurant food safety program for the state. So we don't have a database right now because we don't regulate those facilities. So we'd have to work with our county partners to track down the establishments. If there's an industry organization that we can partner with, because certainly we would have to do training and work through the implementation process. So we don't have that data right now, but we'd certainly track it down.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious how you're going to enforce this. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2919.
Thank you.
I'm going to open a work session. Well, excuse me. Before I do that, I want to say for the record, I am carrying over the public hearing on House Bill 2433 to Tuesday, March 21st, carrying over the work session on House Bill 2347 to Tuesday, March 21st. I failed to mention when we would carry them over to, so I need to do that for the record. And I'm now going to open the last issue of the day, opening a work session on House Bill 2661. And I want to start with Cheryl Hiemstra, please, who's done a fabulous job of leading a work group. I just want to say I've probably had at least a dozen meetings on this issue, many of those group meetings, and some of them meeting with the different stakeholders individually on this issue. I think there's been enormous progress. Thank you to all the stakeholders for coming to the table and really trying to work collaboratively. And then a special thanks to Cheryl, who's done a phenomenal job of tracking every single issue and having us all, okay, how do you feel about that? And tracking this. So thank you. She's gonna summarize what is in the Dash 1 amendment, which is a gut and stuff of the bill. And then we've got about 20 minutes, so we're giving her 5 minutes to do that, and then 5 minutes to each of the stakeholder groups to say where they are on where these amendments are. We're not intending to do passing any amendment or anything. We're working this just for the purpose of letting everyone know where we are in this bill.
Thank you, Chair Kennegar, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Hiemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'll try to live up to expectations. So yes, we sat down with a good number of people on this bill. A lot of people are very interested in it, and it was good to see good participation. We sat down, and this is a gut and stuff of the bill. We realized the bill as originally written got pretty granular about what these referral agents could do. So just backing up again, this is the bill regarding referral agents for long-term care facilities and nursing homes and so forth. And right now, I kind of see them kind of like real estate agents, but they're not licensed or registered or anything like that. So that's this bill. So the original bill had quite a bit in there about pretty granular stuff, contacting a client after 30 days of placement, assessing all their medications, meeting with them in person. We decided, there's probably different business models here that could work, and willing to take that out to get some other pieces in. So those other pieces. There's kind of two different buckets. There's the registry piece, and then there's the disclosure piece. So first of all, the registry piece, after discussions, we decided it would probably be best to be housed at the Department of Human Services. It would be just a simple registry. We're going to need some maybe tweaks there a little bit to add in. In order to be registered, you need to go through a background check. I think folks are willing to do that, and that makes sense in this context as you're dealing with a vulnerable population. And so the second piece was the disclosure piece, and this is where we had a lot of conversation. Made some good progress here, and we might need to continue to do some fine-tuning. So the way the problem is sort of presented is, as I mentioned before, there's one business model where there's a website, and it's kind of like Zillow with real estate agents, where you can kind of look up different facilities. What they end up doing is taking a client's information and then sending out that information to facilities. And then often the internet company and the facility will have maybe a 1-2 year contract where it says, all right, we've given you the name of this client. If that client is placed there, facility pays internet company a fee. And so a lot of people were concerned that they didn't know that their information was being used in that way, was being sent out to these facilities, and was kind of putting them under putting the facility at least under a 2-year obligation to the referral agent. So that's where that big point of concern is. So what we did to kind of address that was more disclosures up front. So giving a description of what the what the referral agent is going to be doing, the fees paid by the facility, if the facility pays a fee to the referral agent, that's disclosed to the client, and whether or not the referral agent only discloses to certain facilities that pay them. So more sunshine, if you will, about how the money is getting transferred here. The second piece is about what happens with the client's information. So that starts on the bottom of page 2. And that says the referral agent may not share a client's information without getting affirmative consent. People want to know where their information is going, which facilities it's going to. So before you share that, get affirmative consent from the client. Probably the biggest point of contention is on page 3, line 6, and that talks about this. We had a lot of discussion about this, for lack of a better term, right of rescission. So the scenario is, what happens if that information goes out to a facility, and then a client no longer wants to work with the person that originally sent that information? They want to work with somebody else, but didn't realize that their information had gone to this facility. And so we talked about a number of different scenarios, and I think you're going to hear some testimony about the point of contention here. But the thing best for the client is that they are able to take that information from the facility and say, no, I don't want that there anymore. I don't want to I don't want to work with that referral agent anymore. Please take my information out of that facility. The reasoning here, these are often very stressful situations when people are getting placed. They might not read all the fine print, and they might not exactly realize where all their information is getting sent out to. So the ability to kind of retract that and say, no, I'd like my information back, so they can control where this information is going. And often it's very personal information that's been sent out. So that's probably the point of contention that remains the biggest one anyway. With that piece, with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
So I just want to say, besides again, thank you. The couple things about this, just big picture, before you hear from individual stakeholders, this was a largely unregulated field altogether, and yet we have some very vulnerable people that I think it's in our interest to try to protect. And so, number one, we talked about whether there should be licensing, or certification, or just registration. Registration is the lowest, cheapest, most streamlined, and that would be covered by fees of people who are, so there's no fiscal impact. Well, I don't know if there's, we'll find out if there's a fiscal impact, but it should be covered by the fees, and we're trying to make it as low-level, streamlined, simple as possible. That was the idea behind this. And then along with that registration, basically we're setting a gold standard, and so people who register to do this have to know that there's an expectation of disclosure. There's another important one here that you may not refer a facility client to a facility in which the referral agent has an ownership interest. There's a lot of really good things in here that I think, unless we hear otherwise, many of the groups around the table, even though they have different business models, agree, because the people who are not at the table were often doing very shiesty operations out there, and there appears to be a lot of fraud. And so I think the people at the table were all really good faith efforts about trying to have a good gold standard quality of service. So there is a lot of stuff that is in here that we have not had as a state that I think is really excellent work. And as Cheryl mentioned, the right to rescind is probably the biggest point of contention remaining in the bill, unless we hear of others. But that is what we want to give people an opportunity to make their case about whether, and I think the people that I particularly want to pay attention to this issue are the ones who expressed interest after last one. Representative Sanchez, Representative Meek, and Representative Noble were the ones that expressed some particular interest in this bill. So my intention in putting it here and hearing an invited testimony from people was to say where we were on this, to allow other people to make a case if they don't agree with the right to rescind before we bring it back and try to work this bill. So thank you. And with that, can we please, let me see, where's the list?
We don't have
a list. It's invited testimony, but Jamie Callahan, would you like to start off then, please? So you each have 5 minutes.
Sure.
I understand you have a video, and you may want to do the video instead of too much invited testimony.
Yes, I am going to keep it very brief. Thank you.
Yeah.
My name is Jamie. I own a senior referral agency in Southern Oregon. I'm here presenting on behalf of OSRA, the Oregon Senior Referral Agency Association. We do have a video in lieu of me testifying today. I think if there's one thing that we really want to get across with this video, it's that our takeaway or our standpoint isn't that we have millions of dollars invested in marketing strategy. We are really trying to do what's best for our aging population. I also want to note that Fred Steele was going to testify today. He's very much in support of what's in the Dash One Amendment. And so without further ado, let's watch the video.
Okay. And if we can't get through the whole thing, you're going to put this on OLIS so people can watch.
Or yes.
I understand it's 7 minutes and you're going to.
It is.
Cut it off.
I don't know what I just did.
Uh-oh. Please support House Bill 2661 to protect vulnerable adults from predatory actors. Although most in the industry provide a high quality service, some actors, often motivated by profit, have started providing referrals without meeting with the senior in question or even inspecting the facilities they're referring to. The state is regulating phishing guides and music therapists, but senior referral businesses and lead generators go without any certification, required ethics, oversight, training, or background checks. Those of us with boots on the ground are observing forms of fraud all around us, and there's very little that can be done about it. Oregon has identified people over the age of 65 as vulnerable adults, yet senior referral businesses and lead generators get away with poor business practices, including referring individuals that they have never met into assisted living communities they have never even seen.
My name is Eileen Renault, and I worked with Senior and Disability Services in Grants Pass, Oregon for about 8 years as a transition coordinator. Before that, I was a case manager, and I was doing placements with my clients into homes. I don't think it's possible to make a sound referral for a person to go into an adult foster home unless I've met with the person first. The reason is to make a good match, you have to know so much about both sides, both about the adult foster home and about the resident you're hoping to place there. The risk of placing somebody without meeting them is that you'll make a poor placement. And what that does is that can put, there's this thing called transition trauma. Whenever somebody moves into a new situation, a new environment, a new setting, there's a traumatic, it's a trauma to them. And there's generally for about 2 weeks, there can be a slide back in their condition. They can decline somewhat. And so you want to mitigate that as much as possible. When somebody's looking for placement, either for themselves or for their loved one, they're generally feeling panicky, feeling lost, feeling unsure, feeling afraid. It feels like a crisis to them. They want guidance. They need guidance.
Did they say anything about the record of quality of the communities in terms of complaints?
That never came up. That level of detail or knowledge about local communities never even came up. The person that actually talked to me from my online research actually did not know much about the community, or didn't seem like she knew very much about local communities at all.
This issue is compounded by national companies that collect names on websites that appear confusingly similar to assisted living communities. Once a name has been collected, these national companies own the right to compensation for that name as a lead per contractual agreements made between the community and the national lead generating company. The consumer never knows that this is happening and doesn't get a chance to agree to it.
Did you know your personal information was going to be distributed to communities?
Absolutely not. I thought, as I said before, that I was talking to a community. I didn't really, and by the way, I should say that I have a degree in gerontology. So for me to be fooled by this is somewhat informative because I should understand this better, but I felt tricked by this online solicitation, I guess you'd call it, because I thought I was contacting a community for information about for my father-in-law, when in fact it was a company that was representing dozens or hundreds, I don't know, of communities to make their commission.
In a nutshell, individuals are unknowingly giving up their names, essentially handing ownership of their name as a lead to a national corporation for an average of 2 years. Arguably, you should be in control of your name, how it gets used, and who it's sent to.
I want to choose okay. who I work with. I want the right to choose who I work with. What do you mean I'm not in control of?
Okay, so if anyone, if this, you'll submit this for testimony if anyone would like to watch the rest of it. And I know the bill does deal with a lot of the issues that were in there. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And so next up we have John Ames. Would you like to come up, Nels? Okay.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nels Johnson. I represent Caring.com. I just want to say thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak to the Dash 1 amendments this morning. We still have some serious concerns that I hope we can work through, and I'll outlay those here in just a quick second. But before I do, I kind of want to frame the issue here for you. When you think about from the moment that someone decides that they have a loved one that needs to be placed in a long-term care facility until that person is actually placed in that facility, there's a lot that happens, and there's typically a long time frame there. And so different businesses have different business models of how much they help you along that continuum. Internet-based companies like Caring.com and A Place for Mom only deal with a particular part of that. What they do is they provide a service that saves you time and money by doing a lot of the research for you. So they contact, or I'm sorry, so an individual will go to a website and say they want to have more information. Then the company will call and they'll have usually about a 45-minute conversation. And in that time, they're gathering a bunch of information about where do you want to live, cost, those sorts of things. And at the end of the conversation, they have enough data to where they can go and they can give you several different referrals. And then it's the client's job to then take those referrals and then actually go and investigate and actually go to the long-term care facility and place themselves and actually go and visit and do the tours and that sort of thing. So the business transaction is really done as soon as the phone call is done. So just as a little bit of context, these companies don't work with them at the whole on the whole continuum. So that being said, just want to point out a couple of concerns that we have with the Dash 1 amendments. Section 2.1, we support the idea of having a disclosure statement. We think that's absolutely, that's fine, that's great. But before providing for a long-term care referral, a referral agent shall provide it with a clear, conspicuous, and written disclosure. Our issue is not with the disclosure, it's that we do this by the phone. So if we can make some sort of adjustment to that, to maybe do that orally, or and we can record that, record the phone call, that's fine. It's not the issue isn't providing the disclosure, it's the fact that we do this over the phone. So a written, as soon as the call is done, we send a written confirmation and a written disclosure. But if we want to do it on the front side, if we can maybe change that to make that oral or something like that, that would certainly be much appreciated. Second issue is section 2.1b, a statement whether the referral agent provides a warranty or another referral if a placement is unsatisfactory. Again, companies like caring.com don't actually place anybody, so there's nothing really to warrant in that transaction. So we would just ask that would apply, that if you are actually placing somebody, that's where the warranty provision ought to kick in, or the warranty disclosure. The next issue we have here, let's see here. Section 3.1, a person may not provide a long-term care referral unless the person is certified by the Department of Human Services. So we're fine with the certification part, but we would just ask for greater clarification on what that means. Does that apply to each company, each agent that works for the company? Who exactly is that in reference to? You know, Caring.com's folks are not based in Oregon, and so it would be a logistical burden to have them register versus maybe having the company do that. It would certainly be much easier. So if we could just get greater clarity on who that applies to, we would really appreciate that as well. And then section 2C says, contact a client that has asked the referral agency to stop contacting a client. So a couple things on that. One is just would ask for a greater clarification on what does it mean when you ask. If I kind of casually ask, does that count? Do I have to do this in writing? That's a pretty vague phrase, and we would just ask for greater clarification on that point, and preferably in writing, especially given the fact that the fine is a $5,000 fine per infraction, that a vague statement could lead to, you know, potentially big fines and even potentially class action lawsuits. So we would ask for some greater clarification there. And then let's see here. Sorry, I'll be brief. Just a couple other quick points. On section 3.2, the department shall issue a certificate to provide long-term care referrals to an applicant who meets requirements and pays fees established by the department by rule. We would ask that in this, that's pretty vague on how these fees are going to be established, that we would ask you to tether those fees to something. What are those fees? What do they pay for? How do you calculate those fees? We ask you to give the agency more clarity on how they're going to do that. Next section is section 4.4x, and that would require referral agents to be mandatory reporters. The issue with that is, you know, caring.com folks that interact with the public have about a 45-minute phone call, so they don't meet anybody in person. The information they have is typically secondhand because most of the people that call are not the people that need to be placed themselves. It's their loved ones trying to place them in there. So it's pretty difficult to be a mandatory reporter when you don't have all of the information.
So if you could wrap up and put the rest in testimony.
Great.
And I know we're going to have another work session to go over all these.
Okay, I can do that.
Not a work session. I'm sorry, a work group.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I can let John handle the issue of rescission.
Madam Chair,
yep.
Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jonathan Eames, here on behalf of A Place for Mom. I had actually testimony prepared, but I'm going to go off script a little bit here and just say I'm actually quite surprised by what we just saw. You know, we've been working in good faith to try to develop structures and a scheme to make sure that the folks that are providing this service are doing it in an ethical in an ethical manner, with the client's best interest at the front and center of what we do. And the approach that we have been working through this work group, we have a bill now and an amendment that we virtually almost all parts have gotten to agreement on. So I was a bit surprised and taken aback by the previous testimony, but I'll try to move past that and focus on kind of where the biggest area of concern and different we have a different idea of where the legislation could go. So this is on the rescission piece, and we've talked to probably all of you about this piece and why this is a real challenge for us. And Mr. Johnson actually walked through how the business works, and I think it's important to understand that what we do is we do a lot of the work even before an individual comes through the or contacts us through, you know, a phone call or through on the website. We have done a lot of an investment in marketing and advertising dollars into trying to, obviously, as an extension of the facility's kind of marketing arm as well, is to help them have eyes on their facilities and the opportunity to get in touch with these folks. And so what that means is that the amount of investment that we put in, there's a lot of risk with that investment. And we understand that that's part of the business. The person who's actually contacting us, it's free for them. They don't pay a dime. The family members or the family, they don't pay a dime, nor are they charged differently on that first month of rent. We explicitly prohibit that with our partners' communities. And so because we've made that investment and we've taken that risk, the contract that we have with the individual facility is to kind of mitigate that risk, is to say, okay, we're going to do this. We know that there's a lot of money that we're going to put up front, but at the end of the day, they may never move into the facility. You know, they could use our service and get this information and the referral sources and never move in. And we may never get paid. We know that that's part of the business. So the rescission part is a real challenge for us, because if an individual does contact us, gets a set of referrals, four or five facilities, that they then decide after that time that they want to work with another senior referral agent, we are put in the position where that individual is able to break a contract that we have with an individual facility, because we don't have any contracts with that member who's contacted us. They're able to break that contract, which is questionable, but also what it does is it puts the family member into a situation where, let's say they do move their family member into one of the facilities that we recommended and that they worked with another senior living referral provider. Who then at that point gets the compensation for that? Is it, and then who makes the decision about how much of that family member's decision went into because of what we provided them or what another senior living referral provider? What our goal is to ensure that the family member who is in a time of potential crisis, they may not be, but they could be, is not put in any of that conflict with a business in a business relationship. We want to get them the information, provide them the opportunity to visit that facility or whatever facilities they so choose to, and then they're done. We don't want them to have to decide who should get compensated in this arrangement. And so it's important to understand how the business works, because the rescission is a very difficult and challenging to our business model, and it would really put challenges on us.
So, yes. Jonathan, if you so we've run out of time.
Okay.
We're leaving the question open.
You bet.
We will work on a lot of the suggestions that you talked about. Well, I'm going to really engage my three people who have expressed interest here to sit down, Cheryl, and all of you, to go over some of these last points. I know that you've got some suggested language about some kind of hybrid in some way, so we will be eager to entertain all those ideas.
Absolutely.
And with that, I'm going to close the House Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Work session on House Bill 2661, and we're adjourned. On House Bill 2661, and we're adjourned. Work session.